Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Amazon says it puts customers first, but its pricing algorithm doesn't. That is the headline of a piece by ProPublica reporter Julia Angwin. She and her reporting team did thousands of product searches and price comparisons at Amazon.com, and they found the online retailer favors its own products even when it costs the customer. It happens, Angwin told me, because of something called the buy box. When you click on a product you'd like to buy, Amazon's computers sort through the hundreds, even thousands, of sellers hawking that exact product. And those computers select just one of them that you can buy with a single click.
That's the winner of sort of an algorithmic game where they all compete to get that spot to be the default seller. And what we found when we looked at it was that Amazon is itself winning that game more often than not, even when its products are not the cheapest available.
And that's not obvious. How did you figure that out?
Well, we figured it out basically because we were testing a bunch of different theories about Amazon's algorithm. Amazon's algorithm is obviously one of the more important ones out there because it is a $100 billion company that if you get a spot on their website, your sales will go up, and it can make or break small retailers. And many small businesses have made their living on Amazon, selling through Amazon, and any change in the algorithm makes a big difference. And so as part of our series, we're looking at algorithms that have really high stakes. The first part of our series was about an algorithm that predicts whether you're going to commit a future crime and is used in the criminal justice system. This one is about shopping algorithm that Amazon has to choose which seller to show to you. And so we chose it because we thought it has a lot of power. And all we really did was very simple, which is just sort of collect the prices over time. Amazon is transparent about the fact that there are these other sellers. If you click to another page, and we looked at all those sellers and sort of saw, well, when do the ones who look like they might have had the best deal actually win? And what we noticed was that there was a huge advantage that Amazon gives to itself and also to its partners, companies who pay them for services called Fulfilled by Amazon, using Amazon's warehouse services.
These algorithms we're talking about are just the default settings on Amazon, right? So I should spend the extra time and clicks to get around them?
Yeah, I think that there's two ways to deal with this Amazon pricing as a customer. One is do the extra click to see what the other sellers are offering. But unfortunately, that list of other sellers, the shipping price for Amazon products is obscured. So if you're not a Prime member, you actually have to put your item in your cart and go to checkout before you will see how much the shipping price is. And sometimes that can really make a huge difference in that true price to you. Now, if you're a Prime member, that doesn't matter as much. And if you are going to get the minimum cart of $49 for free shipping, that also doesn't matter as much. But it's worth knowing that when you go to that list and look at that ranking, you have to remember that there are some hidden shipping costs that won't be revealed until later in the process.
How is this affecting the businesses who sell on Amazon?
So this algorithm, the fact that it's so hard to win that default position on Amazon if you're not paying them to be part of the Fulfilled by Amazon program, is really hard on small sellers. So I wrote about one seller who just took all their products off of Amazon this year because they're a clothing retailer, and clothing was too low margin to afford the cost of using the Fulfilled by Amazon program, which can add about 15% of sales to your costs. And to be fair, Fulfilled by Amazon is a great program. You put your stuff in their warehouse, and they ship it for you with their great shipping that everyone loves. The thing is that there are a lot of sellers who had invested in building their own warehouses and their own shipping, so they didn't really need Amazon's warehouse. And so this is just an extra cost, but what they were finding was they couldn't win any of these default positions or to really drive sales on Amazon if they weren't part of that program.
What is Amazon saying to you about this?
So Amazon says that there's more to the choice of their algorithm than just price, that it's about fast shipping and customer service and other things that, you know, I can't evaluate as an outsider. And I think that is, I'm sure, true. But it's just worth remembering that when we looked at the times in which the default seller was not the cheapest product, 94% of those times that item was either Amazon or Fulfilled by Amazon partner. And so that means that you have to do a little investigating if you really want cheap prices on Amazon, because you're most likely not going to be presented with it at that first moment at the default position.
So I have to work to find the best price. That sounds like life.
That is life. That is true. And that is what Amazon has always been saying that they would clear up for you, right? The promise of Amazon has been, and what Jeff Bezos has been very clear about, is that he wants to be Earth's most customer-centric company. And when he launched this idea of having competing sellers on the marketplace, he had a lot of internal resistance from people at Amazon who said, why would we compete with outsiders when people could just buy the products from us? And he's made a big point of how this is going to be a very objective marketplace, putting the customer first. And I think the reason that we thought our story was news is that it does seem like that has evolved a little bit to advantage Amazon itself. And I'm not saying that that's wrong in any way. I'm just saying we need to be clear about what's actually happening.
Julia Angwin, senior reporter for ProPublica. Her story about Amazon's pricing algorithm is part of a series called Machine Bias. It's about the possible injustices hidden in the formulas that increasingly affect our lives. We're tweeting out a link to that article right now, at KUOW. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Seattle artist Gregory Blackstock has not had things easy. Blackstock is autistic. For years, he worked as a dishwasher at the Washington Athletic Club. Then his art career took off. And tonight, he's coming full circle with a special reception at the Washington Athletic Club honoring his work. KUOW's Amy Radel has the story.
When Gregory Blackstock comes in the door of the Washington Athletic Club, he's on familiar ground. He worked here for 25 years as a dishwasher and remembers everyone, even their addresses and phone numbers.
Yeah, it's been almost 16 years since I retired from the club, and I'm three quarters of a year past 70 now with my age.
Blackstock's conversation style can be unpredictable, heavy on details and references to his favorite old movies.
I like James Mason's Captain Nemo theme of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I like that one, too.
Since his retirement, he's been making art full-time, and his reputation has been growing. But he was unaware that his old employer has arranged an exhibition of his work. The club's vice president, Melissa Borders, shows him the surprise.
Are we ready?
Okay, Melissa, where are we heading?
We're headed up these stairs, and you'll probably see some familiar...
I never knew there'd be some hanging.
Several of Blackstock's framed pieces are now hanging in the club's staircase. They're courtesy of the Greg Cusera Gallery, which represents him. Blackstock draws animals, objects, buildings, always in a series, row after row of them. They look sort of official, like old-fashioned reference charts. Then you realize that they're hand-drawn and have sly, humorous titles like The Pumpkins, Striking Edibles. For that particular drawing, he visited a local plant nursery.
I went to Sky Nursery at Shoreline. I made study and research over there, too, so I how to draw pumpkins.
And there's his latest work, just completed.
Our nation's busiest and largest train stations.
Blackstock's work is sometimes described as outsider art. He's self-taught. For years, he had to balance his drawing with his other job in the hot, noisy dish room of the Washington Athletic Club.
Remember?
Blackstock didn't love that job, but he's glad to see old colleagues like Eric Floyd, now the executive chef.
It's been a long time. Come on, let's go check it out.
I couldn't wait to leave either.
I know, I remember.
Floyd says one thing he remembers about meeting Blackstock years ago was the size of his biceps.
Yeah, guns like this big, his arms were just gigantic because he was always just going and going and going.
Floyd says he always saw Blackstock's drawings featured in the employee newsletter and posted on the walls.
For the longest time, we had a whole little thing in the back of the kitchen we don't have anymore because they remodeled it, of all his art all the way down the line, just the little clippets.
Now his large-scale drawings sell for thousands of dollars. Blackstock's cousin, Dorothy Frisch, says that employee newsletter actually helped launch his artistic career. Her neighbor saw the newsletter and suggested that Frisch contact a gallery about Blackstock's art.
So they met Greg about a week later, and he just brought out rolls and rolls and rolls of drawings. They're very, very large drawings, and he just threw them on the bed, and they started going through them, and they were just almost in tears. They were so excited.
And the rest is history? Well, almost. In 2010, Blackstock made the news for another reason. He was one of the victims of a corrupt financial advisor named Rhonda Briard, who stole nearly $200,000 from his inheritance and savings. It was a huge financial setback. But Blackstock has supporters from all over the community, everyone from Seattle librarians who help him find the images he needs to the Seattle Art Museum, which sells images of his work in the gift shop, and Frisch, who oversees all the logistics that make his success possible.
He has collectors from around the world that really love his art, and the most important thing is that he now considers himself an artist and finds great joy in that.
Blackstock says he has to draw every day because he has so many ideas in his head. Chances are good that at the Washington Athletic Club, as people celebrate his work, he'll be off to one side, happily creating. In downtown Seattle, I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
And you can see examples of Gregory Blackstock's work at our website, KUOW.org. Early in the last century, people of color were banned from living in parts of Seattle. The laws have changed, but we still live with remnants of that racial divide. This prompted a question from a listener for KUOW's Local Wonder Project.
This is David Newman. I live in Beacon Hill in Seattle. And my question is, why is Seattle so racially segregated?
To answer David's question, we set out KUOW's Jamala Henderson.
In order to understand why Seattle seems or feels so racially segregated today, you need a glimpse at the city's past. It's a particular part of its history that people don't exactly enjoy talking about. Seattle is sunny and warm the day I meet up with University of Washington history professor Jim Gregory. We stand on the edge of East Montlake Park, where I can see boaters and their yachts motoring under the drawbridge and through the cut. It's truly one of the most beautiful areas of Seattle. But according to Dr. Gregory, it also represents the city's ugly history of racial segregation.
The Ship Canal is a profound barrier between North Seattle and the rest of Seattle, but also between white Seattle and multiracial Seattle.
He says the physical barrier has actually served as a moat.
A literal moat that has defended, in a symbolic sense, white Seattle from desegregation.
That's because to the north, neighborhoods were very white, and blacks and Asians were pushed to live south of the Ship Canal. In the early 20th century, it was legal for white people to ban blacks and Asians from buying houses in certain neighborhoods. White neighborhood groups and realtors did this by inserting what they called racial restrictive covenants into property deeds.
So other neighbors could sue a homeowner who decided to sell to a person of color, or in many cases, Jews were also prohibited in neighborhoods.
Adrian Bailey remembers what that time was like for people of color. She's 62 and has been an activist and used to work for Seattle Central College. As a child, she was given access to many parts of Seattle that her friends could never see.
My mom was a domestic, so that meant we had to go where white folks were. And me being the youngest, a lot of times I always had to go with her. So I always saw what the other world was.
But later in life, she learned about the barriers she and others had to endure. For instance, Bailey knew by word of mouth which realtors would and would not rent to people of color. And when it came to buying a house,
black people always had to use shields to buy a house.
What do you mean by shields?
White people. If you were going to buy a house, It would have to be the white person would have to be the one to sign off on it first. And then that person would turn around and sell it to you. You know, it was common practice.
Those common practices meant blacks in Seattle were pushed to live in specific parts of the city. And blacks and people of color were also deprived of access to loans and mortgages, a discriminatory practice known as redlining. Today, things are different. Because of steep housing prices, African Americans are being pushed out of the very neighborhoods they were originally forced into. And many have moved further south into areas like the Rainier Valley, Renton, and Kent. In the 70s, at its peak, the Central District was home to about 70% of the city's black population. Today, it's majority white. But there are those with deep family roots in the Central District who are doing their best to hang on to their homes however they can.
My grandfather purchased his first house here in the Central District in 1947.
Ine Wokoma is a photographer and a longtime resident of Seattle's central area. His grandfather and eventually other members of his family bought more houses in the area and lived in them for decades, including the house he lives in now.
My aunt died here. My great aunt died in the house next door. My great uncle died in the house across the street. Having property meant that family always had a place to stay. Meant that you always had people around you who were a part of who you are.
But over the years, financial problems hit Wokoma's family members, and many of them had to sell their homes and move. At their height, members of his family owned and lived in about 10 houses in the central area. Today, they have 3. For Wokoma, living in his grandfather's house gives him a sense of continuity of his family, from the past to the present and even to the future.
50, 75, 100 years in the future. Will there be a place that my grandchildren and great-grandchildren can stand in and know that generations of their families live their lives in that space?
What we see today as racial segregation in Seattle is the legacy of discrimination from the city's past. Seattle does have more areas now that are more integrated than before. But James Gregory says there are still a lot of complicated pieces of segregation that live on in Seattle beneath the surface.
Segregation tends to reinforce itself, tends to perpetuate itself. There are a lot of processes involved. Some involve overt discrimination and subtle forms of discrimination. And then there are also just aversions and attractions that go on.
In other words, there are still people who feel more comfortable living near other people who look like them. I'm Jamala Henderson for KUOW's Local Wonder.
This story was inspired by a question from a listener, David Newman. You can hear more stories from our Local Wonder series at our website, KUOW.org. And while you're there, ponder your own question, will you? Leave us with your own local wonder about the Puget Sound region. And if your question is chosen, then a KUOW reporter is going to run it down for you. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. When I moved to Washington, I felt like Olympia was run by women. That quote is not from a lawmaker. It's from a musician who moved to Olympia to be part of the punk scene there in the 1980s. The scene was a kind of incubator, growing labels like K Records and bands like Sleater-Kinney. Now a new exhibit at the Washington State History Museum in Tacoma looks back at some of the bands who helped create that scene. The exhibit's called A Revolution You Can Dance To. The curator, Len Bailly, says in the 80s, Olympia was an easy place to just get a band together and make something happen.
You know, once you have an idea, whether it's you want to write some songs, you want to put out an album, you want to make a zine, you just go out and do it and put it out there and see, you know, who responds to it.
Without waiting for somebody else to package it for you.
That's right. You know, that's a good way to get your ideas out there by yourself or with your friends and make sure that people all over can hear you.
Well, let's jump right into one example of that. You've said that the group Beat Happening is an example of people just trying to make music. This is the song, I Love You.
I'm on the beach, oh yeah, the rest of my feet, oh yeah, there's Polish pin, oh yeah, we never sin, oh yeah, they fight with Russians, oh yeah.
You know, Len, they're not that good. I can sing that well, possibly play the drums that well, and I don't play the drums.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the main criticisms of Olympia music was people could turn around and say, like, well, I can do that. And Olympia's response is, well, then why don't you?
I, and when I woke up, I had tear in my eye.
You should form a band. You should put out music. You know, if you have ideas that you want to get out there, go ahead and do it. And, you know, you don't have to be the best guitar player or the best singer. You just have to have the desire to do it.
That's a great way to put it, because when I say they're not that good, I'm not wrinkling my nose at it. I'm just, you know, I'm still smiling.
You still get a lot of people dancing at those shows.
And you've said that you can hear how the non-judgmental atmosphere of Olympia let this group Beat Happening progress as musicians. So how did they progress?
Well, I think like a lot of bands, they were able to just put the time in to practice and to just sort of form their own ideas. I've been to a lot of shows in town, especially, you know, back in the 90s, where you walk in and you're just like, whew, at some point these guys are going to have to learn how to play their instruments. But you see that there's the beginnings of something that could be really good.
I think when most Americans think of the Seattle scene from that time, they think of a lot of dudes. But when I think of Olympia, I think of women. I think of Slater Kinney. And will you tell us about the Riot Girl scene and the role women played?
I read a quote from Lois Maffeo, who's, you know, a female musician in town and released some records. And she said something like, "When I moved to Washington, I felt like Olympia was run by women." And that, I thought, really sort of encapsulated Olympia at the time, where there was just a ton of women here that said, "We're going to make some music, we're going to make some art, and we want you all to take notice."
I think a lot of people know Slater Kinney. Should we play a little Bikini Kill?
Sure.
Is this a favorite of yours, Rebel Girl by Bikini Kill?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of fun. I really like music where people are screaming. It's my personal preference.
Me too. Why do you think that took such hold in Olympia and women ran Olympia?
I really think that it was just supportive. You know, there's a lot of great bands that included women in the band, like Unwound. They had a female drummer. And it just, what there wasn't that sort of like, oh, well, you know, girls can't really play music and we're just going to let them do their own thing over on the side. You know, women just sort of jumped in and said, no, we're going to be a part of this and you can't stop us.
What are you hoping visitors to the State History Museum in Tacoma come away with from your exhibit?
You know, I'm hoping people walk away realizing that you don't have to be, you know, prolific in anything specific to be able to get your ideas out, and that you don't have to be this like worldwide presence to say, you know what, I'm going to start setting up shows in my town, or I'm going to maybe put a festival together, or I'm going to get like-minded people together so that we can start doing some more fun artistic things in town that the community can rally around.
Lynn Bai is the curator of A Revolution You Can Dance To, and that exhibit on the history of the punk scene in Olympia is at the Washington State History Museum right now in Tacoma. Seattle's Susie Lee wants to change the way women are treated online and in the dating world. So she started a dating app called Siren. Users answer questions of the day, and their pictures are kept private, all in an effort to emphasize personality over the shopping for humans vibe that Susie was finding on other dating apps. But then, as she moved into this new world of being an app developer, she discovered the industry itself had some people problems. Susie ran into that as soon as she started meeting investors in Silicon Valley.
Think of like the straight white male bro dude. And by what I mean by straight white male is kind of a code and a shorthand for a particular kind of guy, right? Because you, Bill, might be a straight white male, but you might be a really good guy, right? And I know, like, you know, Asian and black men and even women who are kind of that like straight white male bro person. Mm-hmm. So when I pitched the idea to them, they thought, nope, Siren's going to fail because they felt that they were entitled to see everyone's photo and be able to judge them. And so these guys would say, if I don't see a woman's photo, it's because she must be ashamed of herself. She must be fat and ugly. And that was literally a quote that I would hear over and over again. So I thought there were like hidden cameras in the meetings because I just thought, you've got to be kidding me. Like, you really think this is why people feel that they need this kind of safety is because they're ashamed most of the time. And the guys were like, nope, that's not the way I look at life.
Well, how do you know that they weren't correct? They were deciding whether to invest in it, right? So
yep.
how do you know that they weren't correctly describing the attitude of the men who would look at the site and...
Yes, well, I would... So at first, of course, because people give advice, you think, okay, well, at least let me take this with an open mind. And so you just do feedback, right? You ask people whether or not this is something that they absolutely need. And over again, men would say, of course, we're visual creatures overall, but we want some substance, right? We want a little bit of help to start a conversation with somebody. We don't want to be an but these sites kind of make us in a way.
You described Silicon Valley investors. How do you find the Seattle tech world compares culturally to Silicon Valley?
There's a lot of trends that are kind of similar. I mean, there's a kind of an old boys network. And while they, I think, give lip service to, you know, asking and questioning diversity, their actions, I think, speak louder than their words. And so it's still very, very difficult for women and people of color to get funding. And if they do get funding, it's because they're almost far advanced than they should be as far as, like, you know, being a startup. I think that some of the bravado and the really like weird machismo that I see in San Francisco, I see less of here. It's a little quieter. It's a little more Scandinavian. But the tendency is still that when I go to, say, a CEO dinner, there will be 40 men and 2 women. And for me, I feel like they're getting like 2 boxes checked off on diversity. They get like person of color and women. So they're like, we totally have to get Susie on.
So it works to your advantage.
I mean, it can, but, you know, the sense of having an ecosystem in which you're one of very, very few means that you carry a much heavier burden, I think. And no matter what, it's like, you know, for a company, you still need money. And so, you know, instead of getting the $200,000, I would like to get the $2 million. So, hey, investors, if you're listening out there.
How do you feel you're treated interpersonally, I guess, as a woman in tech in Seattle?
I think there's definitely a growing awareness that having an all-male team isn't good for any kind of company. It doesn't promote a different way of thinking or perspective. I remember there was a guy, and he shared the story, where he was trying to offer like why women were important to have in the key business decisions. And he was going to open up a gym. And he and his guy friends thought it would be super awesome to have female showers that were in public view and just lightly frosted. Uh-huh. And his wife, thankfully, like looked at this proposal and said, that is the stupidest idea ever. You're never going to get a single woman in that shower. And I think it's things like that where, you know, guys just have a different way of thinking about things. And so having women or gender non-binary or, you know, someone who's very different than them sort of say, hey, wait a second, actually, there's another way to think about this. It just makes ideas more vibrant.
What effect, maybe Seattle men in tech don't know the effect they're having. What effect does that have on a woman try to work and be in Seattle to have this kind of tone deafness?
Well, you know, there are definitely good allies as well. So, you know, I think that to cast everybody with this kind of aspersion is not accurate by any means. And particularly at a, you know, one-on-one level, you can have very healthy conversations. And in fact, one of our key members of Siren, who's not with us right now, but used to be with us, I mean, he was an ardent feminist. He was somebody who was a long-time coder. His name's David Golightly. And, you know, like, he's someone that in some ways I felt like I was learning feminism from him in a way. But for the ones who I think they have less exposure to women. It's just not something that they think about. So, you know, what you want to have are like women in executive positions so that they can actually, I don't think that they're like, oh, I don't want to have women on my board or on my team. It's more that they just doesn't occur to them as the first level of thinking for a good business decision. So when you bake diversity into the DNA of the company, it means that those things don't matter ultimately to the company, because you're not saying, oh, the woman's now talking, we have to think a different way now. It's more like it's really about the ideas and the, you know, ultimate business goals, and not like, here's the person of color talking, here's now the woman talking. Those are things just get wiped off the table.
So based on what you know, how much do you feel hope versus despair, and why?
Let's use the analogy of you want to rearrange your room and redecorate it. So it's one way, it's not good anymore, you need to make changes. So what happens? You have to take everything down, you have to uncover everything, you discover like really gross things that you're like, I should have thrown this away a long time ago. And if anybody walked into the room at that moment...
Right. It would look like it just got... It's falling apart.
It's
just
total
got 100 times worse.
Yes. And then people are like, what did you do? Right? And, you know, in your mind, you're like, it's okay. I got this. I got this.
This is just the beginning.
Right. But you have to go through that chaos, right? Because if you really want to do a serious redesign of that room, it's not just a matter of, let's move this one object to this shelf. So I think that the ugliness and dirtiness that's getting exposed right now is like literally like it used to be in the closet. It used to be on that high shelf. Let's put it on the ground and let's see what we got and throw some of that stuff away. And so I do believe that it's going to get better. However, again, if we use this analogy, you can also just abandon that room and leave it like that. And it's just this like hot, holy mess. So there always has to be continued work and investment of energy to make sure that it does get redesigned in the way that you envision that it can be. And that requires everybody to kind of do their part to clean up that room.
Susie Lee is the founder and CEO of the dating app Siren. With its questions of the day, pictures kept private, we'll tweet out a link to it so you can look at it for yourself, at KUOW. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. You have an opinion about Donald Trump, but do you understand him? Mike Daisy says he does. Daisy has put on one-person shows from Seattle, where he used to live, to New York, where he lives now. You might know him for his shows about Apple and Steve Jobs, or his show about working at Amazon. His latest show is called The Trump Card. It's playing tomorrow night at Seattle's Neptune Theater, and in it, Daisy tells us why he understands Trump so well.
Because he's a performer. Because he's a performer, and I'm a performer. And he uses those tools of working with an audience in the same way that I do, to different ends, but the tool set is the same.
So as a pro, how good a performer is Donald Trump?
He's very, very good. He's excellent. Because he's extremely good at being himself. He plays the role of Donald Trump beautifully, even when he's being ridiculous and bombastic and incompetent. He's fully himself, you know, like if he was in an acting class, we would say that he was very present. Like you very much feel that he's present when he's speaking to you in a way that you don't with most politicians, generally because politicians are thinking about their responsibilities to constituents and they don't want to say the wrong thing. Donald Trump has pried all the filters off of his id to ensure that he says whatever has come directly into his mind. And that might not be good for politics or running a country, but it is fantastic for performance.
So he's just id, or does he also, are you a magician who can tell us how the magician does the trick?
Well, there are many tricks. I mean, like the whole thing about being magician is a series of tricks, you know, like because he is a performer and he's in this realm of the political, he's able, for instance, to switch topics 6 or 7 times a sentence. Donald Trump regularly says things that begin with him asserting that things are completely in one direction and they end with him asserting their other direction, and in between touches on every possible point, which leaves people who are responding to him in interview situations dumbfounded.
Why would that be a good thing to have somebody contradict himself in a sentence?
No. You're not contradicting himself. Contradicting yourself would require you to have disagreement about what's going on. In each moment that Donald Trump says something, he believes it completely. Like a very classic Donald Trump thing to say is to say, He makes an assertion of some massive kind, like the one he made on Meet the Press, where he talked about how the people in Syria have weapons because Hillary has given them weapons. And the poor interviewer is thinking, I didn't hear that, so probably that didn't happen. But I guess I have to say, how do you know that? Even though in their heart, they're like, that just seems crazy. And then Donald Trump said something very close to this. He said something along the lines of, it's true, and we all know it's true, and people are saying it, and we've been reading it. Is it true? We don't know. We just read these things, and we don't know. And I'm saying we have to get out there and look. And so I'm going to look. We're all looking. We're all trying to find out the truth. I'm going to get back to you. I'm going to get back to you and tell you what that is. That's actually four or five different positions in a sentence. And it ends with him offering to do fact checking for the reporter who asked him the question, turning everything on its head. He's really good at this.
Do you do any misdirection like that as a performer when I'm watching you?
That's all performance is misdirection. Of course I do. I mean, every moment of every performance has a degree of misdirection. And the thing that we have to remember is that that's actually why we come. Like, people like the magician's trick because they do not know how it is done. If they truly wanted to know how it was done, they would dissect it.
You once did a show about your trip to Apple's iPhone factory in China, and you got caught making up some of those details. Do you understand Trump because you're both liars?
Do you really think dramatizing, like, one's story on This American Life, or actually in a play that then This American Life decides to air, is, like, equivalent to Donald Trump?
Absolutely not.
Okay, I just thought I'd ask. It's a provocative question, but I mean...
Yeah, well, it's a theatrical question.
I was just going to say, it's almost as though this is, in fact, a theater of one would ask the thing that would create the provocative situation, then create thing, and then people might say, as they hear the answer, they might say, that's good radio. And I would argue that that is, in fact, theater. I'm not very much like Donald Trump, you know? And if dramatizing personal details in a story about my trip to a factory that then absolutely factually covered the damaging and horrendous human rights conditions are there, if that is being a liar, then I'm a liar. I know today that those workers make more money every hour because of work I helped contribute to. So I live with that. Perhaps Donald Trump has deals he makes with himself in his own life that are similar. It's hard to say. And I dream of a world where people might apply as much rigor as they have to me, to Donald Trump. I just dream of a world where Donald Trump gets to answer questions as hard-edged as that. I think that was a harder question for me than I have yet seen Donald Trump be asked. So I'm waiting to see someone get it as hard as I got it.
You say Donald Trump has hacked journalism.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
That means that when Donald Trump says something, that Syrian example is perfect. He asserts that the Syrians have weapons because Hillary gave them to him. The journalist who's asking the questions knows in their heart that this is not true, because if that was true, Donald Trump would have had to read it somewhere, and this would be big news. So unless he has, like, a personal security force in Syria investigating things, he has just made up something. But he is not allowed to say, by the rules of currently constructed journalism, what are you talking about? He's not allowed to turn off his mic. He's not allowed to be like, get out of my studio. He can't do that. So he has to say, how do you know that? And at that point, Donald Trump gives that complex answer that I just gave you, which ends with, I'm going to get back to you. Donald Trump is not going to come back and be like, you know, I figured out where I read that thing about the Syrians getting the weapons. He never calls him again. And the journalist knows that he's not going to call him. The reason it's hacking is the journalist feels like their hands are tied as they watch him walk right past them.
So if politicians get more like Trump, journalism needs to change?
Well, I'm not a journalist. I mean, I'd love first to tell you that you may be surprised to know that I'm actually a performer. But, you know, there's a dream in America of the dream of objective journalism. There's this dream that I think was born out of there being networks and there being anchors and really impressive older white men who tell you what the world is. I think the first step is accepting that that was always a fantasy that wasn't actually true. And then once you take the gloves off for that, it enables you more accurately to call a spade, because you're expecting there to be multiple different types of journalists covering things from different angles. So if your journalism actually happens to have a point of view, it's not the end of the world, because other journalists will cover it from other points of view.
Should we think about journalism and politics more like theater? Understand theater better?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, the problem is politics is theater. And the fact that Americans don't spend a lot of time thinking about theater actively hobbles them in understanding what's going on, especially in a situation where someone like Trump, who is a performer at heart, instinctively is taking advantage of the naivete of not understanding how theater works.
Well, then let's talk about our responsibility as audience. What do we need to do better?
The same thing everyone should have been doing for a long time, which is to take in multiple different points of view and then lay them on top of each other and examine them next to each other to determine what they do. To be perfectly honest, I think the majority of people in audiences are doing a better job of adapting to the current situation than journalism is, which makes sense. People are always, audiences are very smart.
It's not that all Trump supporters are dupes.
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, one of the things I think is very central to understanding, and one of the things that's very hard for Americans to understand, is how performance is part of everything. For example, journalists have been fact-checking Donald Trump, and it comes up, you know, poorly for him. Like, they're like, "All this is all not true. You say so many things that are not true." And they tell the American people, and then the people seem to not care. And then they actually poll them specifically to say, "Do you care if Donald Trump is lying?" And many of the polls come back and say, "No, we don't care." And journalists can draw a conclusion from this that what it means is that people just love to be lied to. But that's not true. People hate to be lied to. What's happening is these people understand that Donald Trump is a performer. So when Donald Trump says something and it's full of untruths, what they actually say to themselves is, "Oh, there goes Donald Trump again saying those things he says." And they don't believe him. They don't believe him ever. They're listening to him and amused by him, but they don't believe him. And the reason that they're willing then to go along with him is because they don't know that they believe in government at all. And that's the failure from both sides of the aisle of our government in the last 30 years. It's like a lot of his power base is from parts of the country and people who feel left behind by the government and from different directions. You know, people who are susceptible to feeling like our government doesn't do anything for them. Whether it's true or not that it does, they feel that way. And as a consequence, if you don't think the government does anything important and it doesn't matter who's running it, then someone who's a performer, at least they amuse you. And you also might start to think, you know, he's a provocative person. He's interesting. He keeps me listening. Like, maybe he has a good idea. I don't know. And the next thing you know, they're pulling the lever for his side. A lot less of it is this idea that they're just fools, that one day they'll realize that Donald Trump was lying to them. They realize it today. Many of them realize it right away. They're very smart. The audience is always very smart. They just want to be fooled. Like, they enjoy this performance.
Would you prefer it then if there were a liberal version of Donald Trump? A liberal id, liberal lies. But we're all in the theater together, and we know that politician doesn't mean everything they say, but I'm going to pick the liberal entertainer or the conservative entertainer. Would that be a better world?
No, because what needs to happen is that everyone is already embedded in a performance. Like, the act of politics is theater. So recognizing that you're in a theater of this interaction between the audience and yourself, the podium and the crowd, actually understanding that that is your art form, that is actually how you're communicating, is actually how you reform it. Like, if you recognize that's what's happening, then you can start to create a sense of the idea that there are ground rules about the things that we're going to say. You know, it gives you the tools to call someone out who is blatantly breaking those rules, breaking that trust with their audience. You know, it gives you the tools to maybe survive a debate. You know, I, for one, am very concerned about any politician, but in this case, Hillary, walking into a debate with Donald Trump, because I watched all the debates he's had before, and he's finished off a number of his opponents. And it's not because he's smarter than them. It's because he's very present in the room, and he's able to read social cues, and because he's playing it like theater. You don't have to compete with that by lying, and you don't have to not have policy positions or ideas. You just need to actually be present like a human being. You have to be able to perform.
I ask because in your show, a character says, more Trumps are coming, and they're going to do it better than this one did. This one might lose, but there's more to come.
Well, I definitely think that's true. Like, the next person doesn't have to reinvent how Trump built a power base. They will just have to refine on what's been done. The same way that Nixon built on Wallace. Someone can actually just look at this and say, all right, I'll be just like Donald Trump. I'll rouse these same nationalist fervors, but I'll be a little sharper. I'll seem a little more establishment, and I'll hue a little closer to the center. That's obviously coming. And so the things that have started here are not about to stop.
Is it just as likely to be a Democratic demagogue as a Republican?
No, it's not. It's more likely to be somebody, I mean, that's where the bridge has been built, is on the right. So, no, it's not. It's not as likely at all.
Mike Daisey's new show is called The Trump Card, and you can see it tomorrow night at Seattle's Neptune Theater. What about Trump's charitable foundation? The Washington Post reports that Trump allegedly used $258,000 from the Trump Foundation to settle lawsuits that involved his for-profit businesses. We'll tell you some truth about it on KUOW's All Things Considered later this afternoon. I'm glad you're here for KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. For as long as Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer has been speaking to you on KUOW, he has been speaking to you about poo. Mr. Palmer, might this 30-year-old saga be coming to an end?
Yeah, right. You can take it to the bank. How many times have we promised that?
Right.
Sewage treatment is at hand in Victoria. I've done speeches in Seattle. I've done public meetings. I've done phone-in on KUOW, and people always want to know, when are you folks up there going to start treating your sewage? Well, you know, we kind of walk up to it, and we're almost ready to get started, and then we back off and drop the ball. So, we couldn't possibly recover all of the developments in the last few years, but in this past week, the regional government for the capital of British Columbia has decided to go ahead with a sewage treatment plant at the entrance to the harbor. So if you were coming into Victoria on one of the ferries out of either Port Angeles or out of Seattle, there's a cruise ship terminal on the right side, starboard, and on the left side is an old tank farm, and that's where the sewage treatment plant is going to go. People, Bill, who've been following this story for decades, know that that was originally where it was going to go. In fact, they started clearing the site 2 years ago. Local council blocked it, sent them back to the drawing board. They studied a whole bunch of other possibilities and came back and said, nope, that's the place to put it. And this time it does look as if it's going ahead. Probably the reason is that the local government had a gun to its head. The federal government of Canada, the provincial government of British Columbia, promised to pay a third of the cost, but they basically said, if you folks don't go ahead with this by the end of September, we're going to use the money for something else. We're tired of waiting.
Okay, I want to learn more about this sewage treatment plant. First of all, we should understand, how come Victoria doesn't just treat its sewage? Port Angeles does it, Squim does it, Port Townsend does it across the strait. What's the deal?
Yeah, in fact, if you go to Port Angeles, I believe they're in the process of building a new sewage treatment plant because the old one is pretty much worn out. They've had one since 1975. We've just gotten away with it. I mean, what can you say? We've gotten away with it. The national government and the provincial government gave the region, the capital, a waiver. The capital and the region took the point of view that the Strait of Juan de Fuca has a, quote, natural flushing action that just dealt with the sewage, so all you had to do was dump it out there in the water, and that's what we've been doing. There have been various threats, Bill, of tourism boycotts and fines from the national government and everything and over the years, and every time that's happened, the province has said, okay, well, we're going to finally deal with it. Sorry, not the province, the region has said, we're going to deal with it. Okay, we're finally going to deal with it, but they just kept putting it off. And I think what finally happened this year is the two senior governments said, enough fooling around. If you don't do it, you still have to treat your sewage, you're still going to get fined for it, but we're not helping to pay for it because we've waited long enough. And I think that's what finally got the region dealing with it. it does look as if it is going to go ahead. Construction should be completed. Sewage treatment should be online by 2020, 2021, somewhere in there.
You said, Vaughn, that a big reason this sewage treatment plant is going through is that they shrank the footprint of it.
Yes.
Not that we don't trust you, but does a shrinking footprint mean any less treatment of the sewage?
No, in fact, they've jacked up the quality of the treatment. It was originally secondary. It's now going to be at least partial tertiary, so they've actually improved the level of treatment. The shrinking of the footprint, it's weird. It's just a zoning issue. The local government there, the municipality of Esquimalt, they have zoned the site for sewage treatment, but they capped the size of the project. And the previous proposal required a variance under zoning, and the local council used that as an excuse to block the project. So when they redesigned the sewage treatment plant, they increased the level of treatment, they reduced the size of the plant by essentially just a redesign issue, and so the council locally has no more basis to block it. That's the other reason it's gone ahead. I attended the council meeting, Bill, on Monday night, and there's a mood of resignation in the room, but the mayor and the councilors admit it's too late. They can't stop it. It's going to happen. So, you know, I've talked about this on the show many times, so I guess what you'd say is believe it when you see it, but it does look as if within the next 3 or 4 years, we will actually start treating our sewage in the provincial capital of British Columbia, a mere 30 years after we first promised to do it.
Yeah, that's right. Washington Governor Mike Lowry was in on that sewage treatment summit. Okay, we just have a few seconds, Vaughn. Is any part of you then a bit sad about the settling of the sewage?
To lose the story?
Yeah.
No, I've made fun of Victoria often enough that I think it's overdue, Bill. It's time we get going on this.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, good to talk with you. We'll find more to talk about next week, okay?
Bye-bye, Bill.
Thanks again. KUOW's The Record. Get our podcast, will you, wherever you get your podcast, iTunes, etc. Thanks for tuning in today.